Welcome to Anything But a One, Adventures in Miniature Wargaming. Here are your hosts, Tom Castaños, Richard Martinez, and Ray Winstead. Take it away, guys.
Welcome back to Anything But a One, Adventures in Historical Miniature Wargaming. Our topic today, it seems like an obvious one when you say it out loud, but the more you dig into it, it is less obvious. And that is, differentiating between a board game and a miniatures game. Now, so the obvious answer is, well, duh, one's on a board and one has miniatures. But then you've got Axis and Allies that has a board and miniatures. This really all came to fruition with the advent of the rules by Sam Mustafa called Rommel. So as usual, here with us today, we have Richard Martinez and Ray Winstead. And I'm going to let Richard kind of take the lead on this because he was the one that really began to delve into Rommel and talk about first impressions and then where we kind of went with that discussion.
First impressions on Rommel for me is we haven't played it yet, but I am very eager to play that game. I'm very excited, excited for a number of reasons. It plays at a scale that's different than what we've played for in the past. I'm excited to try that. And as I'm sure our listeners have heard us complain ad nauseum about Team Yankee and Flames of War and some of the issues we're having there, this set of rules seemed to resolve a lot of the problems we were having in those other game scales. Problems of parking lots and stacking too close, but it seemed to do it through what I would call a board game mechanic. You know, they had, for example, a stacking limit in a hex or in a square. I'm sorry, in a square. And so it's miniature based. Obviously, like you said, what's the difference? One plays with miniatures and one plays with little cardboard counters for the most part. But yet this seemed to be kind of a hybrid, and I don't know. In my initial thoughts, was that a problem? It's like, hey, I'm not used to dealing with these kinds of terms that I haven't heard about since we left the realm of board games. Things like zones of control and auto supply markers. And those are ideas that we don't normally have to wrestle with in any of the miniature games that we played with before.
That's right.
And so, it started the conversation that we're excited about it. We want to play it. But it came to this part where it was kind of a weird hybrid. And it got us thinking, what is it that makes a miniature game, other than having miniatures, what mechanics in the game system apply to a miniature game versus a board game? Because you're playing with zones of control and supply markers. Does that mean now you're not in the realm of pure miniature wargaming anymore?
Right. I mean, you can glue, as my daughter calls them, little dudes. You can glue a little dude on a cardboard counter and call your board game a miniature game in some ways. But but what do you think, Ray?
Well, first of all, I need to point out, I've not read these rules.
Right.
You guys got the rules and managed to read through them. I don't have a copy yet, and I haven't had a chance to look at anybody's rule book. But that said, for me, the biggest difference between board games and miniatures games, I can't really say the level of abstraction, but the nature of the abstraction. Generally, a board game counter represents a much larger unit.
Right. That's a good point. A board game is rarely a figure or a little five squad, unless you got squad leader.
And miniatures games seem to have a direct relationship, you know, in the number of guys that stand represents. There's a very direct relationship.
Yeah.
And that gets a lot more abstracted in most board games. I like board games.
Yeah.
And so games, there's always a trade-off because you get this very direct relationship to how big your army is and how many guns it represents, so on and so forth, which appeals. But in a board game, you have much more define things that are important, like supply lines, zones of control. Those things become much more dominant.
Right. You know, in a lot of miniatures games, all right, so I think of, zones of control. So a lot of miniatures games write in this kind of gentlemanly rule, and some of them make it more of a concrete rule that if you're like charging into contact, don't be the weasel that just tries to brush it with the side of the unit. Exactly. So you don't get that. And when you're in squares or hexes, you come from the side. You know, there's no gray area about whence that thing came from. So
exactly.
So it plays the referee for that, but then it also limits the geometry. I think that's one thing for me. A pure miniatures game has, on the good side, this unlimited geometry of movement. And on the bad side, it has this unlimited geometry of movement, because that's where a lot of whiny, complainy, bitchy,
that's when things
stomp off, things occur.
Throw my miniatures at the wall, where things usually, at least I guess in our experience, things next to troop ratings, which is another thing. Board games are very directly defined. Your counter usually has an attack number on it. It's got a defense number on it. It's got a movement number on it.
Or some
version
of that.
There's not a lot of debate about how these guys should be rated and how effective they are on the game board.
That brings up an
miniatures. I remember a lot of our games breaking down because we didn't agree with.
Way they rated.
Go
ahead, Rich.
So a couple of points to what we've been talking about. I do agree with what Ray was saying, that you get away with some of those terms, and in miniature games you don't think they apply, but sometimes they just mask it. In other words, I started thinking really hard about that zone of control issue, and in the case of Black Powder, I bring up a game that we played a lot in the past. You have that rule that says if you're within the front range of the first 6 inches.
Proximity rule.
Right, yeah, the proximity rule. You can't do all these crazy maneuvers and go off to someone's side. And so I started thinking, isn't that just a miniatures rule way of saying
zone of control? It very much is.
It just masked the idea, didn't use that terminology. In Sam's rules, he came back and used terminology I was familiar with, and it brought up alarm bells from board gaming.
And that's a good point.
And in miniatures, they do the same thing. They just maybe masked it.
It's a little semantic thing. It's probably pretty much the same rule, but they use the words. Sam really used some very board game language in the writing of Rommel, like zones of control and combat tables. That's the other one we talked about. You know, if you're not familiar with the Rommel rules, every unit has a little three-scale strength thing about how they've been beaten up or they're fresh or whatever. And then you add up how many of those points you have going into your attack, and then there's a little chart. And it's a very kind of Avalon Hill-ish little chart in some ways, that you roll your six-sided dice, and whatever dice you come up with, you look up the column how many points you had, and it tells you what the damage you did. So if you're familiar with the old Avalon Hill world, you had the percentage, you know, 2-1, 3-1, 4-1, whatever, and you went across the top, attacker, defender, you put the numbers, you rolled the dice, and blah, boom, kill, no kill, whatever. Right. So it had that feel, but then the point was, how is that really different than, say, you know, Fire and Fury's musketry chart, where you count up how many people stands are firing, and you go down the one side, and you roll the dice. It really does the exact same thing.
And the idea of what Ray just mentioned, and I agree, too, about the values on a card. You know, you have a little cardboard counter, and it has a generic printed value, and that's what it always goes by. I know normally in some of the board games you're dealing with a particular campaign, so those troops are always rated the same. Sam, the Rommel rules are very reminiscent of that. You have units, and they have an attack value, they have a defense value, but of course, depending on the time period you're playing, those values change.
Right. And the values, the point values for the units change.
Correct. And is that really any different than, let's say, in a miniatures game where you have an elite unit that has, I'll make up an example here, a musketry fire of 2 versus the regular line unit that has a musketry value of 1. You're just assigning points then based on the morale rating, and you can change around point value or the numbers.
And Flames of War actually did that very well, that, you know, certain units in mid-war lost much more than they do in late war because it was new and experimental. But then also in late war, it goes to being really good, but with poorly trained crews. You know, they do that same thing, right. And the point value for those units change and things like that.
So I saw a lot of these same arguments, that we're talking about, kind of went through my mind, and I started just seeing how they were not masked, but how they were represented in miniature rules that we play now. And you saw element, every exact thing transferred, of course, but a lot of things as you thought through different rule sets, you could see it present just with a different name, a different rule, a different aspect or mechanic in the miniature game set. Because in the end, we're all kind of just playing soldier and playing war with both game systems. And so you would expect that to happen. And I don't know why I made such a hard delineation between board game
and
miniature game.
And I want to stress something Ray said, then I'll turn it over to him. We're not bashing board games. We've played gobs and gobs and gobs of board games. It's just in more recent years, more recent decades, we've been very heavily invested in the miniatures games. But it's not to the negativity of board games. There are some phenomenal board games out there. But
no, it's not. We haven't played a lot of board games in a number of years.
Right.
But I've always enjoyed board games.
Right.
It was always nice. What was the Jacinto that did Waterloo?
Then Red Line and Borodino. And Pickett's Charge, Borodino.
Borodino.
Amazing.
Those
games
were great games. You could actually play a large battle and get all the way through the battle.
So here, let me
doing that. And that was important. It incorporated a lot of things into that historical battle that really just didn't seem to work in a miniature.
So here's a weird one. So we just talked about Rommel kind of being teetering on the edge of board game. I would argue that Thin Red Line, Borodino, and Pickett's Charge teetered on the realm of miniatures game. Because for the first time, you had those little long counters that kind of represented lines. Were they battalions or regiments?
Brigades,
maybe.
They were brigades. Yeah.
But it was a very defined, which sometimes, I mean, you have a little X or whatever on a little Avalon Hill counter. But I guess because I knew that order of battle from Waterloo so well, I felt like I was maneuvering the little units around more than in Avalon Hill. The abstraction of the little square counter, and you stacked it up with the rest of the units in the division, and you had his own. It played out to me because of the scale and the beautiful maps that Jacinto put in their games. It played out way more like a miniatures game than a board game in some ways.
That's a good point. I was also going to say as I was thinking through the topic, what came to my mind, the defining point between what a miniature game and a board game, other than the fact that one has miniatures and the other one doesn't, is the fact you take into account fields of fire. You normally have that idea that off the 45 degree, for infantry, you have this arc that it can influence. In board games, a lot of times with the Avalon Hills, you did not. It was just a counter, and you tacked another hex, and it didn't matter from what direction necessarily. It just came in, and then you had no flank and no rear, really. That's where isolation kind of came in and things like that in board games. But you're right with the Jacinto products and the three games you mentioned. It's one of the few board games that I can remember where you had facing to account for. There was a field of fire that could be taken into account.
Yep.
And if it wasn't lined up correctly, then you couldn't shoot it.
Right. And I think that comes to the abstraction level. Well, not abstraction level, the scale level of the game. So, I think of, Avalon Hills, Waterloo. We played that game many, 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 many times. And that included everything from the far western flank, the Howl, and all the way to the woods of where the Prussians are coming in. So, and then depth-wise, it covered Port au Bras and all of that all the way to Mont-Saint-Jean. Jacinto's Thin Red Line was just Mont-Saint-Jean. And, it was just the Battle of Waterloo. It was just Sunday the 18th.
Creeping corner of Plashnau over there where the Prussians came in. Last row of hexes or something like that.
So with that level of abstraction, the things like, so going back to Rommel, every square in the game, and you play, it's a miniatures game, but you grid out your tabletop and cigar box game mats actually even make some that are gridded out for Rommel now. It's the same kind of thing. You've got a kilometer, that square represents a kilometer. And like you said earlier, like if you have a tree in that stand, then that square is forest.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a building in that square is urban. Mm-hmm. Or whatever. So it begins to eliminate, but talk about the little Avalon Hill, you just attack into forest. Now there is a rear kind of thing, but It's still more about just my units going into the attack. And within a kilometer, there's an assumption that these units are kind of all around that.
Right.
They're not in a, like a battle line. It's one thing you've talked about, Ray, in like Flames of War and Team Yankee. It's not Napoleonic.
Yes.
Right. You're not forming a line and waiting for the charge in World War II. It can be defense in depth and all of these kinds of things.
Yes.
So it, in some ways, it can be more representative of modern warfare, maybe.
Because of the abstraction. Because I know it's always bothered us in our games that, yeah, a World War II game looked too Napoleonic and too line-based. And
I know it bothers me.
Right,
It when I'm watching John Wayne, you know, they're not forming Napoleonic lines. You know, I want my game to play like a John Wayne movie.
Well, and a lot of that's us, too, that we don't set up that way. We don't set up a defense in depth. You know, we tend to put everything up on the front, and we typically play on a 4x6. We play on the wide side and not the long side, where you would have that room for depth.
Well, this comes into it. We're also usually only playing a company or smaller,
right?
Which means you don't have a lot of defense in depth. I mean, you are the pointy end of the spear at that point. Whereas in Rommel, I understand you're playing a much larger unit.
Yes.
So it allows for that defense in depth.
Yep.
You have reserves. You have somebody.
Well, and we talked
about a couple of kilometers back that you can call on to come plug
the artillery in Rommel. The big guns have virtually unlimited range for the number of squares that are on a standard table, because like artillery should be battlefront, nowhere near the front lines, unless it's a scenario where you're overrunning the rear area or whatever. Right. If my British 5.5-inch medium guns take sniper fire, I should be drawn and quartered as a commander. They shouldn't be any... If my gun can fire 5 miles, it better be 4.5 miles away.
Yep.
And in Rommel, it does that. It just adds a modifier to the attack for whatever range away that it is.
The scale's more appropriate for that kind of artillery that's there. I mean, not mortars and small ones, but you're talking about 105s, right? That they should be in the back supporting that. And it does take that role.
Yep. And again, you know, is it because it has that board game dynamic? Is it because of the scale of the game that allows you to have that bigger field of fire or bigger conflict area than we had in the past? I don't know. But I'm going to take this a completely different route and going with, and I'm going to put this on Sam Mustafa's games, but it's not his doing. It's how we opted to play them. You know, we also play his game, Blücher. Excellent game,
for a
you know, a larger Napoleonic game that you want. But we opted to use his cards, because they print some beautiful, beautiful cards
for
the Blücher game. And we're in the process of mounting 6mm miniatures on those cards. But that's another one that kind of tips the line. It's a little bit like gluing the little dude on the Avalon Hill counter.
I mean,
you've got
the
counter and you glue the guys on it, and all of a sudden we call it a miniatures game.
Well,
although he's without a square, without a grid system, it's more of a miniatures game than
more
Rommel
free-flowing and moving.
Well, let me ask you guys a question here. Let's go back to the original game that, at least in my memory, blurred the lines between board game and miniatures game.
Okay.
That kind of went both ways. Let me get you all's thoughts on how does Napoleon's Battles compare to Blücher? Because it was kind of, in my way of thinking, it was kind of the same thing. They took a board game with some very board game mechanics, and they just kind of restructured it to be a miniatures game. Now, you weren't using counters anymore, but you could.
You could.
Because as I recall,
it
came with counters.
It did. My first bases.
You didn't have hexes anymore. You didn't have hexes anymore. But the charts, as I recall, and I was not a Napoleon's Battles fan, but the charts, as I recall, after you went through a certain series of thing and actually got involved in the combat, it was a very board game feeling combat mechanic.
It was an abstraction.
You, like 2-to-1, 3-to-1, you roll the dice.
There wasn't like cavalry charge. I mean, there was encounter, you could like counter charge and stuff. But when it came to the combat, it was this mixture of skirmish combat, musketry, and bayonet charge all in one. It was just
Yeah, it was
combat.
All kind of rolled together, and basically I rolled a die, you rolled a die, and the high die won.
The difference decided, which theoretically is also kind of the same way that the Fire and Fury works, and yeah. Age of Eagles works. So,
but it felt different.
Yeah, it felt very different.
I had to sit and think about it. It also depends on when it came in and our kind of gaming, our growth as a wargamer. If I recall, when we did Napoleon's Battles, it brought a lot of new things to the table that we hadn't played with before.
It did.
We were still recovering. We had our Empire 3 hangover at the time still, and Guard the Core and Battles for Empire.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
And so it was so different from those games. I didn't think of it in the aspect of it being board gamey, because it brought in all the other things that were new. It was the first time we didn't have to worry about casualty caps anymore.
Right.
It took it off a stand at a time.
That's true.
Skirmish warfare.
No, you did do casualty caps. Yes.
I thought it came off at a stand.
I don't remember. You did casualty caps in that game still.
Oh, no,
I think
Bar
and Fury is the first
I'm
one.
I'm sorry.
That,
yes,
yeah.
You're correct. Okay, yeah. So it wasn't that hangover that came out of it.
Yeah. Because that's when I first started putting three guys on a base rather than four, because I was cheap, and I said, when you've got three caps on
pretend
there,
still
I still got
there.
One guy
that's
left.
Right.
Yeah, right.
That's right. That's right. What it did do is it kind of standardized the organization of the guy. You didn't form a line of column, and you had these blocks.
Right.
And it talked about how it standardized within that space. It represented them doing attack columns or forming line.
Right. You had line and column, but other than that, there was no distinction beyond that. One was for moving a long way, and one was for combat. Yeah.
And you know, strangely enough, I was okay with the blocks and the idea that you formed it in a block, but with there was this abstraction of what was actually going on. I was okay with that part. Mm-hmm. For some reason, for me, it was just the combat broke down. It became a different game at that point.
Well, okay, so I'm going to say this.
And it felt weird.
So going back to the games that we played, and something we've talked about in the past on other rule systems, I don't think it was necessarily the combat that broke down. I think I could have gotten good with the kind of abstraction of that combat, but they were very heavy-handed with their national rules and their negative modifier commanders. Yeah. We had the guy that always played Russians that disordered every time they never broke because they were tough Russians. On the other hand, they disordered if you like fanned at him, and then he could never do any kind of offensive action.
I do remember that part. I remember that part appealing to me, because I remember it came down to the disruption and the route numbers, and they were very different based on nationalities. And so, like you said, Russians could disrupt easy, but route it very difficultly.
Right. They were like one.
But that was an aspect where we didn't have. Because it was purely based on morale ratings and like Empire and the other games we had played. And there wasn't really a way. If Russian was a grenadier in the Russian army was the same as a grenadier in the French army with the older systems.
Yeah.
In this system, there was a difference because those grenadiers had different values for disruption and routing. And so, to me, that was an appealing part, that you were able to make distinguishments between nationalities because of those ratings.
So they went a really different route. They cut the cheese with the complication of combat, but then they buried you. Remember the chart?
The chart was extensive.
Was extensive for every nationality. Yes. It had all the different modifiers by time period, by era, and by type of troop, and all of that kind of thing. So they didn't make a light game. They just made light combat and chose to just make the difference in the modifiers.
And I think you're right, because my feeling was always that the combat was a different game. And I think I liked the detail that Richard's talking about. And that appealed to me. But when it came to the combat, it's like it all wimped out.
You just felt it was after all of those details, all it came down to was a numerical difference.
I rolled a die, you rolled a die, and it's an oversimplification. But it just felt like I rolled a die and you rolled a die and the high die won. Yeah.
And now, to be fair,
that's exactly how it felt.
Those
when
rules
we
are still very popular. And
they
there are still a number of people that play that, you know, throughout the world, I would say, certainly throughout the country. So as let me take this a different direction. So you started off your comment by saying, okay, well, let's talk about a game that blurred the lines. Well, here's another one from the same manufacturer that I would argue did the same thing, and that's the original basic Squad Leader. Yeah. Now, all of a sudden, we talked about typically your little counter represented a regiment or a brigade or, heck, even a division or a corps, depending on which game you were playing. Now, your little cardboard counter represented a squad. And when you had tanks, you had a separate counter for the turret of the tank to show which direction it was firing. The board, the beautifully illustrated hex-driven boards, had shell holes and foxholes that counted for defense when you were in them. Now, again, we're not even talking about ASL. That's another podcast and a lot of therapy. But the basic Squad Leader game, I would argue, blurred that line again. But and I played Squad Leader, and I seem to remember kind of enjoying Squad Leader. But at
I
that
enjoyed
point,
Squad Leader.
I think that
I didn't play it a lot, but I did enjoy it when I played it.
But I think that was the board game that made me want to do miniatures, because at that point in time, I'm rolling around with like two tanks and a bunch of little squads of infantry. Then I'm looking over my shoulder at my Kitty City stash of Airfix HO little dudes, and I'm thinking, crap, we could play this game that way. And that kind of led to that.
You make a good point. I remember even in some of the expansions, you would stick the machine gun in the church tower, and it had a certain field of fire, and it covered certain areas. So, yeah, it was a game that had many aspects of a miniature wargaming in it, even though it had cardboard counters. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, maybe the best idea is that there's always a blending of those two ideas to make a good game.
I think this is – maybe this, maybe it's just us.
It could be that.
A lot of times – a lot of our discussions, I think this is like episode 17 now or something like that. A lot of our discussions come down to the kind of like the aesthetic of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, with that board game to miniatures, you exchange aesthetic for the confidence of the limits of the hexes and squares and little cardboard counters. You know, you love the little model trees and the figures. And with that, you accept. There's going to be, you know, when H.G. Wells wrote Little Wars, did he in his wildest dream imagine that we were going to take high-end 20th century technology, like laser pointers, and sit there and argue whether or not, oh, no, that's outside of 45 degrees. You can't shoot with your cannon. That's how we got laser pointers, and we're trying to do GPS to figure out whether or not I can wing your column with my cannon. And if it was a board game, that would never be a thing. It's you count hexes you're in.
Never played Little Wars, but wasn't the basis of that game is you kind of lined everybody up and you tossed like marbles or at them?
Sort of, kind of. And I have a copy of the rules, and I have threatened that we will play a game of Little Wars.
I'm all for it.
But we're going to play it with, we're going to go get the Green Army Men from the dollar store, because if you're chunking rocks at my figures, it's not going to be my painted army.
It had some mechanic where
The little cannons.
You went back and forth, and you had these little like catapults or something that
the little guns fired a little cork, and it knocked over guys. But I'll tell you what, I will send y'all each a copy of those. They're way more advanced than you think they would be, but they're pretty bizarre. But nonetheless, I mean, I don't know that there were many board game kinds of war games at the time, but he and his gentlemanly friends took their oversized figures out into the billiard room, and they got on their hands and knees on the floor, and they played these games. So is it just a simple exchange of the convenience of the grid versus the aesthetic of the little modeled battlefield?
I know for me, aesthetics is a big deal. It's a real big deal. And that's why, given a choice between a board game and a miniatures game, I'm generally going to gravitate towards the miniatures game.
Yep.
I'm much more attracted to the really elaborate table with all the trees, buildings, and roads.
And you're ready to accept the lumps of it not being as clear cut.
I think so.
Okay.
It's maybe counterintuitive to do it that way because of some of the things that I nitpick over. But it is what gets me going. I enjoy the putting nicely painted miniature. I like the way it looks.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a big, and it's part of my, because I've always said, I'm the Walter Mitty type. I imagine myself commanding, and it just adds to that illusion.
Yeah,
when it,
more than
when
a little
when it comes
stack
together.
Of cardboard counters. Final thought, Rich?
I think it would lend more to the aesthetics. You brought up something, so did Ray, that we haven't even discussed yet, and that's the idea of, you know, modeling and terrain. I mean, we always have it in our best interests. I mean, we always have it as a goal that we'll create more terrain, create more scenery. We're lucky to get our models done. Yeah. But it's a goal that we aspire to.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it very intriguing like that.
And I guess it's the point out here. Generally what happens is we decide on something, a game system. We all buy miniatures. You guys paint your armies, and I wind up building a bunch of terrain.
That's right. So I'm going to leave it with this. Everything we've just talked about might suggest something we've thought for quite a while, that Sam Mustafa might be a genius, because he might have found that beautiful mix of the comfort zone of the board game rule and the aesthetic of the miniatures, and we'll let you know as soon as we play it. I'm also going to tease that we have an interview with Sam coming up sometime very, very soon. So, you know, we'll take it straight to the source for this one very, very soon. Guys, thanks again for joining us. Remember, if you like the podcast, tell your friends about it, share it. If your podcast app has a rating system, please give us a 5-star rate. It really does help other people find us. If you're on our anythingbutone.buzzsprout.com page, the little heart in the corner allows you to buy us a beer for as little as $2. You can help donate and keep this podcast running. Thank you so much for Richard Martinez, Ray Winstead. I'm Tom Castanhas. We will see you guys next time.
This has been Anything But a One, Adventures in Miniature Wargaming. Find us on all your favorite podcast apps or on our webpage at anythingbutone.buzzsprout.com. Please subscribe to the show and rate us 5 stars. And of course, tell your friends. See you next time.